Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth with the Friday Roundtable. This is the show where we invite three smart people into the studio for a conversation about the week's news or a big idea. Today, three people who have a lot to do with shaping your child's college experience. As many high school seniors look ahead with some trepidation to continuing their educations, we're going to talk about what colleges are and aren't doing to maximize success. So how is the student body changing? Why are so many students still taking more than 4 years to get a degree? Is college getting any more affordable? Three college presidents for the roundtable. And your thoughts, too. How well do you think colleges have responded to deep concerns about graduation rates and tuition costs and the needs of students? You can tweet me with that at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I. NPR. Our guest today, Dr. Fainice Miller, is president of Hamline University. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Dr. Brian Rosenberg is president of McAllister College. Always a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Devinder Malhotra is president of Metro State University. Welcome. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Do you mind if I use first names?
No. All right.
Thank you to all of you. That's, I really appreciate that. Devinder, I'm going to start with you on this question that I'm asking listeners to think about. I want to know how you think colleges, yours and others, whether they've heard their customers, the students and their parents, on tuition, on the time that it takes to graduate, and other concerns. Are schools leaning into these issues more urgently enough?
I would say yes. I think as institutions of higher education, we've gotten a lot better over the years. There is still room to improve and grow, but I think we are much more attuned to the issues of affordability. We are much more attuned to the issues of accessibility. We are much more attuned to the fact that our student body will become increasingly diverse, and particularly here in Minnesota, that diversity to a large extent would be driven by immigrants, and that brings in a very different lingual and cultural context to it than otherwise would be the case. I would say yes.
So where's your evidence for that, though?
I'm looking at Metropolitan State, for example. You know, 40% of our student body comes from communities of color, and I would say that large number of them are first generation, second generation immigrants who come to us. So similarly, the 70% of our student body is either comes from communities of color or is Pell eligible, which is a proxy for low income, or are first generation college entrants.
So you're saying our student body testifies, basically, that we heard the needs of community. Brian, what would you say?
Well, the most concrete evidence that colleges are responding on the issue of cost is the fact that, net cost, what people actually pay, has gone up much more slowly than the sticker price. In other words, colleges are providing a lot more aid. So as the cost of college has gone up, and it's gone up more quickly than the ability of people to pay, colleges are filling in that gap by providing more and more aid. So among private colleges right now, what we call the discount rate, the percentage of tuition that we don't charge, is going up about 3% a year. So colleges are helping to make their institutions more affordable by providing students with more aid, some of it need-based, some of it merit. So it has not gotten as expensive as quickly as the sticker price would suggest.
What is the main reason that college still continues to become more expensive? I hear you on the financial aid, but why is the price continuing to go up?
What's driving up the price of college more than anything else are personnel costs. Two-thirds of the budget at McAllister and at most colleges and universities go to the people who work there. And it costs more every year to hire educated workers. And so the single biggest driver of our increase in costs is the increase in our personnel costs. It's very simple. If we're going to give our employees raises, we have to raise our tuition. There's relatively little in our budget that is discretionary, that we can control, and that we can reduce. The only real way to make a substantial reduction and the costs of college is to make a radical change in the delivery system. And so far, we haven't quite figured out how to do that and maintain quality.
Fainice, evidence at Hamline that you've heard your customers, the students and their parents, on grad rates, the amount of time it takes to get through school, and more accessibility and affordability. This is Exhibit A at Hamline. What would you say it is?
Well, I think we do a very good job of getting our students through. And at Hamline, we have over a third of our students who are first generation. A significant number of those do not live on campus. So they have the extra challenges of having to take full load of classes plus work. So we have in place a Center for Teaching and Learning to work directly with those students to make sure that they're able to get the classes they need, that they're doing well academically, and that they're on track to graduate on time. So there are resources in place to work directly with these students. So we're paying very close attention to graduation rates. We're also paying very close attention to retention rates, because retention rates really are the factor that you need to look at when you talk about completion rates. How well are you retaining the students from one year to the next? And if you're retaining a significant number of your students, then it means that they're really on track to graduate on time.
Let me throw this in there since we've come to this topic. New study out from the Center for the Study of Race and Equity in Education at the University of Pennsylvania. African-American men are dropping out of college at disproportionate rates. So whatever's happening on college campuses, it is not solving this issue, particularly if they've come to that college as an athlete. And given how essential a college degree is for particularly that population of college students, something is still not working as it should be. Mm-hmm. What would you say the problem is?
Well, let me just say a lot of the problem is what is the purpose of the institution? What is the mission of that institution that they're attending? And I hate to put it that way, but that is the case. If your goal is to be excellent in athletics, sometimes, not all the time, sometimes the students put more emphasis there than they do in the classroom, and there aren't the resources to have to follow them to do the kind of work that they need to do.
So is that the fault of the institution itself or
If students are not getting through our institutions, we do have to look at what we're doing that might be negatively impacting their ability to do that. At Hamline, our athletes graduate. We have a very good athletic director who monitors it. And I will tell you what I do as president. I can tell you the grades of our athletes because I monitor their grades. I also know them. So when they see me, I will ask them, what classes are you taking? Are you studying? What exams do you have coming up? How well are you doing on those exams? So they know I'm going to ask those questions when they see me.
I mean, do you have the same, you know, Hamline's a small school with, I don't know where the teams are ranked, but do you have an expectation that a Penn State could accomplish the same kinds of monitoring that you do? Is that what you're suggesting is the way to solve some of this?
They should. We have a responsibility to every student who comes to us. I think when you're a small institution, you do know your students. And you know them well. And you have the people in place who are constantly monitoring them. When you're a larger institution, there are more factors that are involved. That's not to say that they don't do a good job, but they don't graduate the athletes at the rate that the privates and small liberal arts colleges
University
do.
Of Minnesota has an issue with this. Brian, a thought on this?
Yeah, well, you've raised a couple of important issues. First of all, we simply have to acknowledge that the educational system in this country, beginning from the pre-K level and moving on up through college, is imbalanced, and that not all students have equal access to a high-quality education. So we shouldn't be surprised that imbalance carries through to college. That is typically populations of color, urban populations without resources, have less access to high-quality education from the time they enter the system.
Being the K-12?
K-12 system,
right.
Even pre-K. And so we shouldn't be surprised that imbalance, that inequity carries through to college. And it does. If you look nationally at statistics, as you say, students of color, particularly male African-American students, graduate at a lower rate. The Division I athletes actually make up a relatively small percentage of that number.
Mm-hmm. But if I could interject here, it depends on the institution that they're attending. If you go back and parse that data, that when those African-American males attend small private institutions, they're much more likely to graduate than they do if they attend large urban institutions.
That's true. That is true. And that's actually true for most students. The graduation rates at small private institutions tend in Minnesota and nationally to be considerably higher than the graduation rates at large institutions, public and private. So there is a difference among institutions, but there's still an imbalance. The other point I would make that you raised is about Division I athletics. It is, in my view, a major distraction from what should be the central mission of a university to place as much emphasis on athletics as most schools that have Division I sports do. It's very, very important to distinguish between the kind of athletics that you see at a Hamlin or a McAllister, which is Division III, mm-hmm. no athletic scholarships. We essentially don't treat our athletes from the moment they're enrolled to the moment they graduate any differently than we treat our other students. That simply cannot be said about Division I athletics.
And you mentioned that the accessibility issue starts early on in the process, K-12. Mm-hmm. I think what you've just said about the emphasis on athletics does, too, mm-hmm. in a lot of communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do we get there?
I'm not sure, but it's quite different from any other place in the world. I mentioned to you that I just got back from visiting China and Japan, and the role of athletics in the education system in those countries is minuscule compared to the role of athletics in the American K-12 system.
Yeah, actually, I'm happy to report that I'm fortunate I don't have to deal with these issues because we don't have athletics at Metropolitan State.
You don't, but you must look at what's happening in higher education at large and be greatly concerned about it.
And I think to the point which Fainese was making and Brian made it too, that when we talk about student athletes, we should emphasize the term student rather than the athlete. And thereby, you know, looking at them with the kind of support structures they need. It is true that those student athletes have greater demands on their time because of their engagement with the sports they are involved with. And that is true at any level, of whether it's Division I, II, or III. It is true that the pressures are greater in Division I. And I think, and in that sense, I think the real key is to integrate the overall support structures for athletes within the university's overall support structure. In fact, in some instances, in some universities, sometimes athletes have a better graduation rate than the others because of the support structures they have, which are a lot more intensive, they're a lot more labor intensive, and they're a lot more engaged.
When I ask, so how did we get here, and you look at what seemed to be the kind of upside down priorities in some of these schools where the athletes are not graduating at high rates and the focus seems to be so much on athletics and not academics, isn't it money that's really dry? Isn't that the reason this continues?
Yeah, it is. But I want to speak to that issue, but I want to also speak to the importance of athletics for a lot of these young people. So growing up, athletics can be the stabilizing force in many of these young people's lives. So I wouldn't want us to see athletics as a negative, but to see athletics as a positive. It's how when the money situation comes into play, how they're then treated as commodities.
Yeah, but you know, I look at the way Europe does this with high schools. Many European high schools do not have the kind of teams that we have within our high schools. They have leagues in their communities. And so the focus is on academics in high school. And if you want to join, you can get all the benefits, right?
You can, but it's not our structure. Our structure is that we do have those teams. Also, remember that school, especially high school, is a social place for students, mm-hmm. as much as it is an academic place. So some of them go there, and that's where that social community, that support system exists for them. So if you've got a coach who is really actively involved and engaged in the life of that student, that can be a reason why that student grows. So I wouldn't want to negatively view athletics in our secondary system. I wouldn't want to do that because I think it does have a major benefit, especially for kids who are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds.
But
on the other hand, when they get to college and we begin to look at how much money an institution might be getting as a result of their ranking, their TV presence, those kids then can become victims within that structure.
I think you started off this discussion by referring to the dropout rates among African American students.
Yes.
And I think
men particularly.
Yeah, men particularly. I think that's why when it comes to achievement gap, I would say it's a mistake just to focus on athletics. You have to focus on the overall achievement gap. And there again, you know, there are a lot of different approaches one has to take. One has to take a very comprehensive and structural approach. First, we have to raise the aspirational level. That's where Brian's argument that we need to engage them early and convince and embed ourselves in the communities and convince that college is not only possible but doable, and provide the kind of information fairly early on so they start thinking about college. And then once we get them, then we need to also understand that they bring with them particular social, cultural, economic context with them, and that has to be taken into account as we do that.
And when you say they bring that with them to the college campus, right?
Yes.
That has to be aware of
that.
Yeah,
we have to be aware of that. And our support structures have to recognize that and accordingly adjust to it. Our academic support structures have to recognize that. So we have to look at their ability to perform both inside and outside the classroom. We have to create safe environments for them in which they don't feel that particularly their cultural, historical, ethnic identities are under siege. And I think so in order to do that, we have to build up network of communities. At Metropolitan State, for example, we have a lot of older students who work.
Mm-hmm.
They have work commitments and family commitments. So what we have done is, in our student center, for example, there is a space where students can engage in group studies. But along with that, there's also space where they can bring their children and they can play while they're doing their schoolwork.
You're actually part of this trend of students with strollers that I was just reading about in The Atlantic. Yeah.
Yeah, and right? We have a parent center at a university where students who are also parents, they create a network of communities. We have students who are homeless and are students who come from very disadvantaged background. So we have we partner with other organizations and we work through and see if we can find support for them outside where they can stay. We have food shelf. We have a lot of other structures in place. So it goes beyond just focusing on the academics, because I've found that by our research, it shows that the high rates of dropout or stopout, which we have, where students come for a semester, then they drop out for a couple of semesters, then they come back, it's often driven by non-academic factors rather than their ability for academic prowess or potential.
Brian?
We serve a very different population,
right?
Obviously. Our population is a much more traditional 18 to 22-year-old undergraduate population. So we see these issues manifest themselves in a different way. But the fact remains that even at a place like McAllister, the experience of a first-generation student acculturating into the institution is quite different, often, from the experience of other students. The experience of students of color coming into the institution can be quite different. And so I think all of us in our own context are trying to think more fully about how to make that experience more successful for those students. And so we like all colleges, most colleges now, have added programs that didn't exist 10 years ago that focused in particular on populations like first-gen students, on students of color. We have seen our retention rates go up in all of those areas. So I think that intervention can make a difference, even when students come in with somewhat different levels of backgrounds and different levels of cultural experience.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's something that we do a couple times a year. We invite college presidents from the region in to have a conversation about some of the issues they're seeing crop up on college campuses, some of the things we're hearing from our listeners, and in some of the discussions I'm having with you about college affordability and graduation rates and those kinds of things. And so that's what we're talking about this morning with three college presidents. Dr. Fainese Miller is with us from Hamline, Dr. Brian Rosenberg with us from McAllister, and Dr. Devinder Malhotra from Metro State University. Brian, there was a time when we would hear the CEOs of companies in the region say, you're sending us college graduates that don't have the kinds of skills or the academic knowledge that we need. Has some of that diminished? Do you hear from people like that still? And do you have a sense that you've figured out a way to resolve some of that, or the CEOs have given up and moved on?
I don't think they've given up and moved on. I think they realize that the success of their businesses depends upon having a robust, educated workforce in the state. So they know that it's very important that colleges produce the kind of graduates that they want to hire.
And do you think that's happening? Not just in McAllister, but...
Yeah, I think that most CEOs are looking for people who have certain fundamental skills. The ability to write, the ability to speak, the ability to be creative, the ability to work in teams, the ability to be resilient. And I think by and large, they think colleges are sending them those kinds of graduates. I think sometimes that perception doesn't filter down to human resources departments that tend to be somewhat more narrowly focused on a particular major or a particular body of knowledge. And so that's where I sometimes hear about a mismatch. I'll hear about companies that are looking for lots and lots of majors in a particular area, and they're saying that colleges aren't producing those. My contention tends to be that if you have a smart graduate from a good college with the right set of skills and the right habits of mind, that graduate can adapt to almost any position. And that if employers are willing to be a little bit more flexible in how they think about their entry-level hires, there are plenty of people coming out of Minnesota colleges that can fill those jobs that they say are sitting empty.
Yeah, I'm smiling at this because, Fainese, maybe this happened at the last school in Vermont that you were at, right? Mm-hmm. That's where you were. But you would hear companies say, how could it be that we have, you know, these schools in Minnesota and all these graduates, and yet we still have to train these people once they walk through the door and they don't come in with the skills that we need? I don't know if that refrain is as loud as it once was, but what's your answer to that?
Well, I think one of the things that we are doing is that we are working collaboratively with the corporations with internships. Mm-hmm. To give our students that kind of hands-on experience that they need. What they're talking about has nothing to do, to some extent, with their ability to write, the ability to think, the ability to compute, all of those kinds of things that are really necessary. What they're sometimes talking about is that practical stuff that isn't necessarily taught. Because sometimes you get the theory and not necessarily the practice, or you get the theory and the practice not necessarily connected. So by working collaboratively with the corporations, what it allows us to do is as soon as they get both. So we're hoping that that conversation or that comment is not as ringing as loud as it once was because of those collaborations.
But if these are skills that can't be taught, you know, where's the college's role in that?
Well, I think Brian is right, is that not every skill should be taught, because
like the resiliency and the grit that I think that's everybody talks about these
well,
days.
Well,
right?
That's something that grows. I mean, if you really think about a 22-year-old leaving a campus, and I'm going to say 22-year-old because that's a traditional age student, leaving a campus and going, you're asking them, if you're asking them to be resilient, to have grit at that age, and not to have life experience, you're asking something of them that you're not asking of other people that you might employ. Yeah. So I think we have to be very careful about that because, you know, but if they have the ability to think critically, if they have the ability to be creative and innovative, they can actually bring something to that corporation that allows them to have that next patent or that next, you know, great idea.
Yeah, I have a little bit different perspective. I really don't think we have done enough to allay the concerns which are out there. Because I think
among the employers,
because as institutions of higher education, we have traditionally paid a lot of attention to the academic rigor of our programs and courses, as we should, and that's very important, no question. But we haven't paid much attention to the relevance of those programs and what they and how relevant they are to the work life of our students and to life in general of our students, and we haven't paid them. Paid enough attention that are we preparing them to live and work in a very, very diverse environment where aspects of democratic engagement also will take a lot of different shapes and forms given the overlay of technology and the communication as it has evolved.
Is that something that the college really has to teach?
Well, let's go back to the 1990s when businesses would not hire people who had business degrees. And they wouldn't hire them when they had business degrees because they said they didn't have the ability to think critically. They couldn't step outside that training that they had and think in a variety of different ways. So now we have them saying that, you know, they can't think critically. They would hire the liberal arts graduates. That's what business was doing in the 1990s. That's what they were doing. So I think that this is going to be something that we're going to be dealing with, that as we try to address the concerns that they're raising, we have to be very careful in how we're doing it to make sure that we are creating students who don't have that basic knowledge that allows them to be able to be fluid with regardless of where they might be and what type of job.
But it's not an either or choice.
Yeah.
I mean, I think ultimately we not only want an effective business leader with all the business expertise, but we want a well-educated, effective business leader with all the expertise which the businesses want. And I think that's why this distinction between professional education and liberal education is a false dichotomy, at least in my mind.
Brian, what would you say?
Well, I'm not sure there's a lot of empirical evidence. Colleges are not perfect, but I'm not sure there's a lot of empirical evidence that we haven't been producing people whose education allows them to live more successful lives, both in professional terms and in broader terms. I think that if we focus too narrowly on vocational training, we limit the possibilities of students because those vocations will change. If you think about the jobs that existed 20 years ago and the jobs that existed now, they are, of course, dramatically different. And we have to assume that the students who are graduating from our institutions right now will be doing jobs in 20 years that don't exist. And so if we're only preparing them for a particular job, we're not preparing them adequately for that future. I think by and large, colleges have done that. The most common concern I hear expressed by employers is not your graduates aren't sufficiently prepared. It's that there aren't enough of them. If you look at Minnesota and you look at Minnesota's future, the single biggest problem we face will be a shortage of college-educated workers. We are not producing enough people in Minnesota to meet the needs of our employers 10, 20, 30 years down the road. And the only way that we will produce enough of those students is if we start educating more diverse populations in the schools.
Especially when you see numbers that came out this week that more people are leaving the Twin Cities in Minnesota than coming in. If we don't have enough college graduates, you're going to have to find those people somewhere.
Right. I think for employers, that dwarfs all of the other problems that we're talking about.
Devinder?
That's correct. The fact remains that we are not preparing sufficient number of students for sufficient types of emergent occupations in today's knowledge-based global economy, because that's what has led to talent shortages.
Give me an example. I mean, is there a job that...
For example, let's say the emergent need in healthcare industries and healthcare professionals, the emergent needs in the information technology and information assurance sector. Those are two areas. And there are other areas, too. There is a lot of research which has been done where what are the shortages and in which areas. And I think what is happening is, the question is, are we nimble, flexible, and adaptable as higher education institutions to meet the needs of those talent shortages which are emerging? And are our programmatic structures well aligned to it? I agree with Fayonise. The one thing which we have to do is, if our students are going to out there in work life and work in teams, then it makes sense to develop curricular designs which are not based on the epistemologies of specific disciplines, but on phenomenological approaches, where a lot of different expertise comes in to solve a given problem. And that's why a higher component of experiential learning within our academic programming was very, very important, as Fayonise were referring to. That's where internship and other elements come into play.
Yeah, I think Davinder is right, is that when our students have an opportunity to use what they've learned, it really means that when they graduate, they are ready to do the work that needs to be done. But also remember that we're preparing students not only to be workers, but to also be good citizens. And so we don't want to sort of have that somehow get lost in the conversation. So we want them to be really part of a civil society. But I think that we have to pay attention to what some of those emerging trends are, and to be ready for them as best we can. So that we do have to do.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable of three college presidents, Dr. Davinder Malhotra with us from Metro State, Dr. Brian Rosenberg with us from McAllister, and Dr. Fayonise Miller with us from Hamline University. We'll get a look at the latest news, and then we'll continue our conversation.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. A new blast has been heard from a police operation in a Brussels neighborhood that once housed a hideout for the suicide bombers who targeted the city's airport and subway system this week. Reporters at the scene described hearing a new detonation, though it was unclear whether it was a controlled police detonation or something else. Earlier, a witness speaking on Belgian state broadcaster RTBF described hearing two blasts and shots from heavy weapons during a police raid. At least two Americans were among those killed in Tuesday's terror attacks in Brussels. Secretary of State John Kerry confirmed the fatalities in a news conference today in Brussels after meeting with Belgium's prime minister. Kerry is vowing to step up counter-terror cooperation. French officials say a man arrested yesterday outside of Paris has connections to the suspected ringleader of the Paris attacks. Authorities described the man as a 34-year-old Frenchman who was convicted in July for being part of a recruiting network for jihad in Syria. Meanwhile, six people are being held following raids in Brussels yesterday. Prosecutors will have to decide whether to charge or release them. Syrian state media and opposition activists say government troops are engaged in heavy fighting with Islamic State militants on the outskirts of Palmyra. The historic town in central Syria has been controlled by the extremist Islamic State group since May. The militants have destroyed and blown up some of its most famous archaeological relics. The Syrian army, backed by Russian airstrikes, pushing to recapture that town. Christians are marking Good Friday in Jerusalem. A procession of thousands walked along the route believed to have been walked by Jesus to his crucifixion. And in the Philippines, devotees in three villages north of Manila reenacted the suffering of Christ by being flogged with whips while walking barefoot. They were nailed to wooden crosses by actors dressed as Roman centurions. More ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:40.
Later on All Things Considered, it's Friday, so our resident pundits process the week in politics, and then the Cube critics set your silver screen agenda. I'm Tom Kranitz. Our Friday pair of pairs and all the day's news. Join me on Minnesota Public Radio News starting at 3. Coming up at 10 on Weather Lab with Paul Huttner, weather forecast models, how good are they and how good can they get in the future? Plus, in Climate Cast, walleye in Lake Mille Lacs. Is climate change a factor? It's coming up at 10 o'clock.
programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by our members and by Prairie Restorations, designing, installing, and maintaining landscapes for homes and businesses throughout Minnesota. Information on the locations of their offices at prairieresto.com.
Programming is supported by Minnesota's non-game wildlife program, bringing you the Eagle Cam, trumpeter swans, and other wildlife since 1987. You can find ways to help at mndnr.gov/non-game.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable of three college presidents, and I want to pick up on some of the things that have emerged here in the conversation. Brian, you were saying that when you hear from business on their greatest concerns about college education and future workers, it's that we won't have enough. How can a state that is still lauded for its education system be looking at a future that doesn't, and I mean K-12, even though we've got some serious problems with the achievement gap, be looking at a future where we are not going to have enough people going to college?
Because those problems with the achievement gap are dramatic. The achievement gap in Minnesota is the highest or among the highest in the country. One of the problems with averaging everything together is that it can obscure difficulties. And so when you look at Minnesota in total, it appears that our K-12 system is very strong. But if you break it down to distinctions between white students, students in affluent school districts, populations of color, students in urban school districts, and some rural school districts, you see dramatic differences. And most of the population growth, if not all of the population growth in the state going forward, will be in those populations that are currently underserved. And so unless we figure out a way to close that achievement gap, and unless we figure out a way to send more of those underserved populations to college, then what is currently a strong knowledge-based economy will not be able to persist. So we look okay. And in many ways we are, but if you dig a little bit beneath the surface, there are some very serious problems. And my sense is that business leaders and at least some political leaders recognize this, but we haven't yet figured out a way to change it.
So when I introduce the roundtables, I say we invite three smart people into the studio for a conversation about it. Here are three very smart people. So let's not pass it off and say, unless we figure out a way. What's part of the answer? What kind of ideas do you come to this discussion with?
Well, one of the things we have to look at in the state of Minnesota, we have about 58,000 teachers. About 500 or so of those teachers are teachers of color. We have a significant number of the paralegals in our schools who don't have those next degrees that could be, who are people of color, who could be actively engaged with kids in our classrooms, but aren't able to at the level in which they could be. So I think we really do have to take a look at who's in our schools, who's able to be in the classroom in our schools. What are we doing to increase the number of diverse teachers that we have in our schools? So all of these things are things that we have to pay attention to.
So I want to understand what you mean when you say that. So if the person at the head of the classroom is a teacher of color, the connection with a community of color might be deeper. You might be role modeling for kids to say, that could be my future too. I mean, is that where the connection is here?
That's some of it. We should have a diverse workforce in every possible way.
But how does that get to getting more of the underserved?
Well, if you've got people who understand where the young people are coming from, one would hope, and I don't want to make the assumption that it automatically occurs, but one would hope they understand what that particular child or what those children need in that classroom. They understand that when someone misbehaves in the classroom, that don't automatically send them or discipline them. There might be a way in which you can understand that child's background and then be able to put a curriculum in place that responds to what that child might need.
Okay.
There are a lot of things that we could be doing very differently.
So that's one idea. Devinder?
Let me pick up on what Brian said. I think he's absolutely correct, because it's a question of access. And in order to provide the access to communities who historically have had low participation rates in post-secondary education, it is very, very important that we integrate the experience of the student all through the student's academic journey, starting from pre-K to college and then beyond. And in order to do that, the different segments of the education sector have to start talking to each other. You know, we can't just say that, look, K-12 system is not preparing the students adequately, or they are not academically prepared, they come. We have to engage in a conversation, as Fairness was saying, with the K-12 and make sure that we do put teachers who are going to be effective in the classroom, and we increase the number of teachers from the urban communities themselves.
But I'm pressing you all on this because for a long time it's been, we've got an achievement gap, we have to do better. And so far, it's only widening. So more specific ideas on how to solve it.
First of all, we have to begin by acknowledging the extent of the problem. It is true that there has been an awareness of the achievement gap for a long time. But still, when I talk to groups of Minnesotans and I give them statistics about how wide that achievement gap is, they appear to be surprised. And so I think there needs to be a broader and deeper awareness of the extent of the problem. And then we have to ask ourselves if that's the kind of community we want to be. So it has to begin with a real and deep commitment to change. For me, I would start with the kids when they're as young as possible. I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the earlier you intervene in the life of an education of a child, the more impact you will have. I'm a big fan of the research of Art Rolnick at the Minneapolis Fed, and he's demonstrated pretty convincingly, at least to me, that putting aside ethical questions and questions of equity, the return on your investment for dollars you spend on pre-K education is about the highest a society can get. So I would make significant investments in early childhood health and education, get children onto the right track from the beginning.
You know that's something that Governor Dayton wants to do, and he's gotten resistance the education
he
community.
He has, and there are, to be fair, there are different ways to do it. I am not sure that I am a big fan of universal free pre-K education.
Why not?
Because I think when dollars are finite, they need to be directed at the populations that need them most. And so the child of a college president doesn't need free pre-K education to the same degree that a child in an underserved community does. It's a little bit like free college, free public college for all, of which I'm also not a big fan. I think you need to devise policies that address the problem. And I think our problem is inequity, and I don't think we best solve it by making everything free for everybody.
I agree with all of that. I will tell you when you begin to see, when all of those things are in place, let's think back on Head Start and what Head Start attempted to do. When those children got to third grade, they began to slip. So something is happening around that time, even when they have the early intervention. And that's the reason why I think you have to look at who's in our classrooms. You have to look at what their training has been. You have to look at what's happening to those children outside of school. So the early childhood, I think, is absolutely key. I think we do need that. I think we do. I'm not in favor of universal pre-K either. However, I do think we need to have pre-K for every single child.
Yeah, I think along with what both Brian and Fainey's have said, we also have to address a very fundamental issue, and that is that the achievement gap persists in institutions of higher education too. It is not limited to K-12. And I think purely from that perspective, one has to think through as to how we are going to address them. And in that context, there are some longer-term approaches. Both Brian and Fainey's have referred to them, engaging with K-12 and those kinds of approaches. But there are some low-hanging fruit, too. I'll give you just one example. You asked for a specific example.
Yes.
I'll give you one. Last year, for example, we looked at students who had dropped out when they were within one or two semesters of finishing. And we identified over the last 3 years about 550 such students. We sent them all a letter which also had accompanied with a very structured degree completion program, given what they already had done, and we offered them a small scholarship. Last fall, 57 students took us up on that offer. Mm. And I'm happy to report that within the fall semester and this spring semester, within this academic year, almost all of those 57 students will graduate. And many of them come from communities of color. And, we have about 40% students from communities of color. But each entering student in Metropolitan State will finish with a baccalaureate degree in 2.7 years. It's true that most of the students who come to us are transfer students, and they bring with them the first 2 years of their academic training. But I think one has to impart some intentionality which is aimed at these populations. That typically has not happened. Typically what we have done in higher education institutions is that we have kept our current ways of functioning the same, and then in that fine-tune, tweak, add, subtract on the periphery some support structures. We have to start thinking it in a much more integral manner.
One more question here, and you raised it, and I'm curious about whether Fainice and Devinder agree with you that free education at public universities is not a good idea either. Why not, Brian?
Because I think it will disproportionately benefit the wealthy. I think that it won't change any of the challenges that we're describing. That is, if you make, for example, the University of Minnesota free,
yes,
it's not going to do away with the achievement gap. It's not going to do away with the fact that different student populations will have differential levels of preparation. And you will be, in many cases, directing public dollars to people who can afford to pay the tuition that the university currently charges. I think those dollars need to be apportioned on the basis of need.
Fainice, this is something Bernie Sanders has been, from your former state of Vermont, has been talking about.
Yes, he
a
has.
Lot. What do you think?
I don't agree with Bernie on this issue. And I do think that, as Brian has said, the people that it will benefit will not be the ones we want it to benefit. And I also think the other factor that we have to take into account is that what we will probably see is graduation rates go down rather than up when it becomes free. Because the resources that many of those young people are going to need when they go into school, they won't have available to them. It also means that if you're not doing, one of the reasons why students of color don't do well, especially Black males, is that they won't go and get help when they have a problem. And if you have an environment like that, you're going to find them because they don't want anyone to know what they don't know. And you're going to find that many might be going and the help isn't going to be there. And it's going to continue to contribute to the problem. It's not going to improve it. So, and I also think you in some ways do away with the notion of choice.
Of choice.
In that if something is free and someone doesn't want to go there, but they have to go there because that's where someone says they go, because that's where the tuition will be paid for, it means other opportunities that might be available to them, they won't be able to take advantage of.
Free tuition at Metro State, is that the answer?
I agree with my colleagues. I think the problem with free tuition is not the fact that students, it won't increase access and affordability for the students, but the fact that it doesn't address the inequities which currently exist in terms of that access. But I think the more fundamental problem behind that proposal also needs to be addressed, and that is the question of access and affordability. That is the question of student debt, the amount of debt students are graduating with. And I think I'm much rather attack the problem there rather than just going straight to free tuition.
I was just thinking whether I could have predicted what the presidents of private colleges would say about that, but you kind of surprised me on this, Devinder.
You know, even when I was at the University of Vermont, when Bernie was kicking some of these ideas around, I didn't agree with it. I do think that Devinder's right. It doesn't address the real issue that's there. Also, I don't think access will increase. I think access will decrease.
It will not bring more people into college.
I don't think it will. I think because if you are looking, if the focus now is on completion rates and retention, the probability that someone who's perceived as coming from a risky environment, mm-hmm. being accepted, might go down. Whereas now you find that we're more likely to take those risks on those students and help them get through. But if the public is going to be concerned about completion rates, there's going to be less of a willingness to accept a student who might have some potential but hasn't shown it yet.
And play out for a minute in real life the impact of, again, making, say, the Twin Cities campus at the University of Minnesota free. What that's likely to do is dramatically increase the competitiveness of the institution and make it more likely that high-achieving students will want to go there and get in, and less likely that students who might be perceived, as Finis says, as more risky or higher need would not get in. The University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus already has a higher socioeconomic demographic than the average private college in Minnesota. Making that school free would just exacerbate that. And while it does, in fact, seem self-serving for private college presidents to say we don't want public colleges
to be free. I wasn't really suggesting that, but I hear you on that.
I mean, the reality is that one of the strengths of the higher education system, both in the state and the country, is the diversity of entry points. Many leaders of historically black colleges and universities, for instance, have said that if you make public universities and colleges in the South free, you will put us out of business. And those institutions are a critical part of the education system. They have higher graduation rates within the education system than the public institutions.
And they produce more doctors and lawyers.
Yeah, exactly. And so there are all kinds of ripple effects from that proposed policy, which is a great talking point, that I think those who are supporting it haven't really thought through.
And there is also some impracticality to it, too, because I think most of the public sector of higher education is funded by state governments. And at the state level, even these public universities have already become increasingly privatized.
Yes.
Because 15 years ago, almost 60% of our total revenues would come through state allocations. That is reversed. So now only a third to 40% will come through state allocations. In some other states, that amount is even less. So in some sense, I think the question is, I would be happy if the balance goes to 50-50, and, you know, in other words, we move that, because that will have a tremendous impact on access and affordability, but more importantly, it'll also have an impact on our ability to support students in a manner that we can minimize the amount of debt they have to take while completing their programs.
I usually close with reading recommendations, but I'm going to ask you for them, and we'll put them on the thread, okay, at nprnews.org/thread. Thank you all for a really good conversation. We didn't cover a whole lot of other stuff, but we'll do this again, okay, as the school year gets going in the fall.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Our show is produced by Markita Fornoff, Maddie Mahon, and Jeff Jones. Our online team is Stephanie Curtis, Michael Olson, and Tracy Mumford. You can hear our programs anytime by subscribing to the podcast. Search for NPR News with Carrie Miller in your favorite podcast app, or go to nprnews.org/podcasts.